Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
if I had $1 million.
Well, no big snacks and jacks. Not tomorrow. Andrew on the board. SP Futures down 15. NASDAQ Futures down 154. This is after a big up day yesterday as a way of review. S&Ps are up 65 and NASDAQ was down 329. So we're kicking back about a third of that on the NASDAQ and maybe a quarter of that on the S&P. Oil's up to 87.12 is this war. It's been over five or six different times. 3 days from now, it seems to be getting worse instead of better. So I don't know what the story is there. But we have Professor Kevin.
Yeah, you do. Good morning.
Morning. Did you manage to make it through the last two innings of the Cub game last night when they had the position pitcher in there? The Cubs didn't score in the last inning, I guess, but did they do that just out of charity or what? That was pretty weird, if you saw that or not.
Yeah, they probably wanted to go home as much as I wanted to go to sleep, so which I did, by the way. I did not see the last couple of innings. So
neither did I. I did the our buddy Sutcliffe was pretty outraged about the whole thing, wasn't he?
Well, I didn't see that either. I don't know, but they actually, you know, the MLB has some specific rules about them. I can't cite exactly what they are, but you have to be down by a certain amount and have to have used pitchers. I get it, even though the pitching staffs are much bigger than they used to be. Managing the bullpen is probably the hardest job for any manager, and you probably, if you can save your bullpen an inning or two, it's probably not an awful thing.
Well, I mean, Sutcliffe said, you know, and I like him. He said that there's degrees basically to this insanity. He goes, when he was on the Cubs, they did it a couple times, he says they always use Doug DeCenzo. And everybody used to give him grief because, I mean, if he said 1 year Doug DeCenzo's ERA was lower than mine, so I never stopped hearing about it. But he said Doug DeCenzo was an outfielder. He was a pretty good hitter. He was a kind of a role kind of guy. He said, but the dude pitched for Florida State. He was a real pitcher in college.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, so, you know, he was a position player, but he could throw a decent ball, and he had a curve ball.
There's actually a lot of those guys in the major leagues who pitch at lower levels. I've seen situations where a guy was a pretty good hitter as a pitcher and they converted him to an infielder.
Well, but I mean, he said he'd never seen a thing like last night. He goes, this is like softball. The guy's just, he's just lobbing it in there. I mean, literally, the ball was coming in at 35 miles an hour. He goes, I've never seen anything like this. He goes,
if you remember Steve Hamilton? Yeah, he used to pitch that way and he was a real pitcher.
Well, I mean, no, this was so, we're talking about the guy throwing the ball. This is what a guy was just throwing a regular ball 20 feet in the air.
It's like watching a batting practice pitcher.
I don't know. This guy couldn't
get. Maybe not even that good.
Yeah. And it was. Who was the guy swung and missed? And everybody was laughing at him. One of the guys with the Cubs swung and missed on one of these floaters. It was like a blooper every pitch.
Well, who was it? What was the guy's name? He was a White Sox hitter, a hot. And he came up hot out of the minors. He was sort of like an early version of Moises Ballesteros. And Tony La Russa got all over him for hitting a home run off of a position player. He said it was bad etiquette. And, you know, it was one of the ways that Tony La Russa began to lose the White Sox when he was, when they brought him back a few years ago.
The guy, it was a very Spanish name. left-hander, and the guy came up, he was hitting like over 500 until like the middle of May, wasn't he? Didn't he have like seven hits in a row or something at one point? The guy we're talking about? The guy you're talking about.
For the White Sox, yeah. I can't remember his name now.
But he was the...
He played out as quickly as he arrived on the scene.
But the weird part was that the Sox kind of knew he was going to flame out. They never even gave him a chance. As soon as he flamed out, he was gone forever. There was no chance to go to the minors, get the thing back together, bring you back. Same thing that happened to Ballesteros, you think?
I don't know. They may still see Ballesteros. I think everybody believes in him as a hitter, but when he had to make adjustments and at the same time Conforto was doing really well in the DH role, and so it was more important to the Cubs to get Moises some at bats than it was to keep him on the bench there.
Is he still playing every day at Triple A? I haven't checked. I don't know.
But let's see.
Let's pull up the Iowa Cubs roster.
I was pretty stunned the other day when people talk about guys in professional ball and like they suck and so forth. I was pretty stunned when they were talking about the Ryan Dempster. It's getting to the point. I mean, there's nothing horrible about the guy, but I like this Alex Cohen way better than Boog. I don't know if that's just me or what, but anyway, they were talking about only 2,500 people in all of baseball have ever made it 10 years.
Yeah, I heard that conversation. That was interesting.
I don't think regular people, unless you played a lot of sports, I don't think regular people have any idea how much better these guys are than anybody you've ever seen. I mean, it's the gene pool. I mean, I marvel at how good some of these people are, how athletic they are, and so forth. We were watching a guy last night. I went to the local emporium, and we're watching the Cubs, and all of a sudden you see some guy. What the hell did he do? The guy comes in, I think he's on the other team, and he's from the outfield. He comes in, he slides for the ball, catches it, does a big slide, and then he's on his feet without ever touching his hand to the ground. And I said to the guy, could you do that? And he goes, I just watched that. He goes, I could never do that. Who can do that? It's like people who slide and pop up without even using their hands at all to get back up. That was not me, Kevin. I don't think it was you either. You were a little better at it, but every time I slid, I just tore myself up. But,
you were playing on Chicago softball fields. I mean, that's, you might be picking chicken bones out of your thighs if you slide anywhere.
Well, but I'm saying the athleticism these people have is something that most people don't even realize, if you watch them. I mean, the ability to see that catch Pete Crow made? How far he ran for that ball?
Yeah, and I think, I don't know if you watch Quick Pitch ever on MLB Channel. It's like the first thing I turn on in the morning because they just buzz through all the games showing, showing the highlights. Well, that's a nice catch on the highlight film. But the part you don't see on it is that what makes it a spectacular catch is exactly what you said. It's the ground that they cover, not the finish of the catch. There's a lot of guys, if they had to make that catch, it would have to be a sliding catch or something like that. He gets such a good read off of the bat, which is just an extraordinary snack to develop.
He was in right center. Plus, he's fast as the wind.
How much of that is development?
Well, there aren't a few people in the history of baseball that make that catch.
Right, and he makes it. Without crashing into the wall, without diving, without anything else, he just ran down the ball, and that that was Willie Mays material.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ballesteros is still playing. He's still in the lineup regularly. He has played for them. Where'd the stats page go for Moises? He's played like 24 games, and his average is .258, and his on base is .384, which is really nice, and his slug. So he's doing well. He's not kicking booty at it's 755 OPS, so he's not getting a lot of slug, but he's getting on base a lot.
which is good for him. It's good for anybody to get on base a lot. The problem is, if he's not getting a lot of extra base hits, then taking a lot of walks means that you're going to do a lot of station to station as he moves around the bases, because he's not very fast.
Well, the whole point about you're only going to get walks, well, certainly in softball, where you can kind of put the ball where you want it. I won't say that every single pitch, but you only walk people if you're afraid of them.
Well, yeah, or if you're, some pitchers who just get the yips.
Some people are just wild, but.
Are just wild. I mean, there was a guy the Cubs had several years ago, Tyler something or other. They acquired him from the Rockies, and this poor guy, not only could he not throw the ball over the plate, it was non-competitive pitch after non-competitive pitch. Everything was a foot outside, a foot and a half outside. And the guy finally, the second year they had him, got it together a little bit, and he was, reasonably effective. But, man, his first year, it was like they had to just take him out of the lineup. He couldn't pitch because he just could not throw the ball over the plate.
You know, I saw something talking about you reach back in your experience.
That's also Sir Anthony, what's his last name? The pitcher on the White Sox right now, they got him to be the closer, and he's not the closer now. Sir Anthony Dominguez, I think, is his name. And he's an experienced guy who's been around a long time, and he just can't get the ball over the plate. It's terrible.
Are you going to hit the bull?
hit the bull is fun, yeah.
I saw something the other day, brings back a memory. Talk about people that are a little off. Well, you think they might be a little off. Anyway, there was some, you see everything. People write up, they must have nothing to do. There's all kinds of, evidently some guy from the Blue Angels in one of their shows buzzed something, and they're trying to think if they're going to discipline the guy or something, whatever, give me a break. I was at a Cub game, and I think it wasn't the Blue Angels, it was the Air Force Thunderbirds, and they're doing their stuff. They're at the Cub game, and all of a sudden, Kevin, one of the guys, and I don't know if he ever got spanked for it or what, but he comes, the other three guys are up doing whatever it is they're doing. He came by Wrigley upside down. I don't think how many feet he was above Wrigley. I won't say full afterburner, but the whole place shook. He came when he went back out to the lake. He was five stories down from the top of one of those buildings. That's how low he was, and the place just went. Well, the Cubs had this wacky guy. If I knew the name, he was a big right hander. He had nothing but talent, but he was just a kind of a space cadet. He pitches the ball. The guys go by. The batter, the catcher, and the ump both totally bail out. The timing was unbelievable. And the ball comes flying in and goes right to the backstop. There was no batter, no catcher, no ump. The pitcher is bitching a blue streak how he wanted his strike, that the ball was a strike, and nobody called timeout, and it should count. And the ump, the catcher are looking at him like, what are you, from Mars? Everybody, you should have seen how fast these guys moved away from the plate. They thought the plate was going to blow up or something. Everybody just scattered as the guy pitched the ball. But the whole stadium just... I mean, it was friggin' loud. It was scary. I don't think the guy ever got rid of. Maybe people thought it was cool or whatever. But the guy wanted his strike. And I'm sitting there going, I don't know how long you can argue this one. But
I always bitched about everything, so I don't know why.
That ball was a strike. What do you mean it was a strike? The guys were like halfway to the dugout. I don't know why they thought it was safer somewhere else, but they all, as soon as the batter left, the catcher and the ump ran too. It's like the weirdest thing. But anyway, I saw that at the Blue Angels, and it rekindled that was on with, by the way, I was on with Joel's guy yesterday, Josh, and for a half hour on their podcast. It was kind of fun. Evidently, they reserved me for all these, like, economics questions. They had people calling in and stuff. It was pretty interesting. Kind of a different thing when you're the guy being questioned rather than the other way around, but anyway, it was kind of fun. It was a nice, different view. You speak to kind of a different audience. People are calling in, what stock should I buy? And that kind of thing. You got to be careful about answering those. I will say, though, Kevin, since we are Stocks and Jacks, the money I manage for people, a lot of the latest clients have been people with single stock issues. When I say issues, a lot of a single stock. Well, it's a good issue, right? I mean, if you got a whole bunch of Apple, well, guess what? You done good, kid. That kind of thing. But you still get people looking at the averages, you know, sort of like people looking at economic numbers. If you don't know how they're made up, you can look at the averages. And like yesterday, you know, Microsoft was down $3. Micron, for whatever reason, was up 100 again. The ability of individual stocks to be being up and down here, you just can't look at the averages unless you're in the averages. I mean, if you're in the SPY, guess what? You can look at the spider. But if you have a stock, you can't just look at it and say, oh, man, the market's up. I must be doing good. I've never seen this kind of rotation back and forth, which makes, you know, my job, well, makes my job better because people give me more stuff to manage, but it is really something. I mean, the other day when a lot of the chip makers were absolutely getting their ass kicked and the transportation average is up 3%, you sit there and go, wait a minute. You got people calling their broker, I'm talking about showing my age, saying, you know, sell Micron and buy me a trucking company? I mean, really, Kevin? It seems like I don't think we've ever had an order like that in 40 years in business. I mean, sell Micron, buy, you know, J.B. Hunt. I'm like, are you kidding? Is this a joke? I mean, it could happen, I suppose, but in the amount of rotation flying back and forth and the news just pushing this stock, pushing that stock. Oh, no, these guys are, their AI is going great. Oh, wait a minute, China's got an AI place. They're going to be cheaper than our place, and they all go down. Oh, ah, screw the Chinese guys. I mean, this is, it's signs of a real kind of a frothy thing. It's nothing that you can put your finger on, nothing you can trade on. But as I mentioned to the guys yesterday, you look at the Japanese situation. The yen keeps going down, 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 and they keep bailing out of, you know, U.S. Government securities. Okay, well, in the meantime, U.K. is pretty much made up for it, so we're sort of even. Now, what if something happens? Okay, but all this information, Kevin, you can't just say, oh, man, Japan's in trouble, buy puts on the market. I mean, because none of this stuff is tradable, but it's there as well. You know, you can look at, other stuff. You can look at the last 2 months of the amount of increase in margin loans, which is like an absolute record of a two-month increase in margin loans. You can go, wait a minute, that's not healthy. But doesn't mean you go out and buy puts in the spider today either. I've never seen so much kind of weirdo information affecting the market and hovering around that doesn't seem to be tradable, yet it's there. You know, and you wonder if it's just a lag time to it, or if it's just going to go away the next 3 months, the margin loans go down and we're back to where we were and it's no big deal, or it's going to keep going and people are going to borrow more and more. It's really strange. I don't know if you're picking that up from listening or not, but there's a lot of balls in the air, and it seems like none of them are really tradable, but at any one given day, any one of them could be. You know what I'm saying? It's really strange.
Well, I think people will react to data, and data is not, in and of itself, is not useful. There's a big difference between data and information, and I think people react to data as if it's information often. Information is when you take the data and you organize it and you find trends and you find patterns and you are able to slice it and dice it according to different scenarios or different groupings. You know, think of COVID and, you know, how, you know, every day we would get here's the number. We have crossed the threshold, 500,000 COVID deaths. We have crossed the threshold, 1 million COVID deaths. That's data. What was information at the time was, first of all, how many people died with it versus because of it. So we didn't have that delineation. That would be an interesting question of what the data is telling you, what's in the data. The second thing is by age group, by comorbidities, by region. All of those kinds of things, that's information, and that's not what got reported. We had the world reacting to data, and the data, and there was so much more information in there, and we just, you know, as a result, we were creating policy based on the data, and it was crappy policy because we had crappy basis for it.
Why don't
I think you see that in the investment? I am sure you see that in the investment world.
Oh, I bet for sure.
Every time there's an earnings report or a number, You know, I mean, you get the unemployment numbers and you take a deep dive into it. But how much are people reacting to the overall, well, we created X thousand jobs and the unemployment rate is, you know, 4.1 or 3.8 or whatever number they're going to give you. That's just data. You have to take the dive into it to see what's really going on. And people don't do that very well, including people who get paid to be able to do it very well.
Well, you wonder if they're getting, you wonder, Kevin, if, and I, you know, as I mature, I'm getting much more, conspiratorial and something. You know, stages of knowledge, stages of life. You used to see this stuff happening, right? When we were in school and so forth. And then, we had all kinds of problems with the economy when you and I were in school. We had the Arab oil embargo, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I get out of there, and I go to the University of Chicago, which is a whole different world. It was like a think tank. And maybe because I was lucky enough to be able to only take 9 of the 20 courses in the business school, I was able to take them in economics and stuff like that. And you learn from various classes, you know, kind of the stuff that you're not been teaching much lately, but you had a couple classes where you talk about management and using information, and you kind of learn. First of all, you get the feeling that the information that was bad were people that were doing the best they could, you know, whatever administration was in. It must have been Nixon. I don't know who the hell was in there. But they're doing the best they could, and if they screw up, it's because, you know, something didn't work out the way they wanted it to. But then when you get in some of the classes I had in Chicago, and a couple of my professors were really onto this for some reason, and they would talk about how you should be able to predict every time the way you count something, whether the thing you count is going to be any good based on what you did. So as time, then all of a sudden you're a young guy, you bust into the business world, and you're thinking now that people are kind of knowing all this crap, basically, that going forward things would be better. People would learn either not to do that, or other people would recognize the scam for what it was. I mean, I would say that everybody on this show, maybe I was the first to lead into it, once you gave hospitals a 20% kicker on their Medicare bill or whatever it was, Medicaid bill, if somebody had COVID, I mean, I knew instantly that all the COVID...
Everybody's got COVID.
Everybody's got COVID. I mean, but why is it? Why was it just us? That this should be... You shouldn't be able to get away with that, I guess is my question. Everybody should say, wait a minute, you just screwed up all your statistics, you idiot. I mean, but nobody did, it seems like. Or maybe a few people did and nobody listened to them or whatever, but...
Well, I think the people who report this stuff are just... I won't say stupid, although some of them I do think are stupid too, but ignorant of how numbers work. And we talked about this. This goes back to, you know, discussion when Cheryl Atkinson was on the show.
Yeah.
If you don't have the subject matter experts, they don't understand those pieces of, of the subject. So they're just asking questions and getting answers, and they don't even know how to go through and do follow-ups to them. And so that's a problem. And that one is what you would chalk up to ignorance. On the other hand, you also have the situation of some of it's willful. Do you think that the people who are running the National Institute of Health and CDC and so on, do you think they don't know this stuff?
I used to think they had to. I'm not so sure.
The ability to just throw out statistics and have people react to policy, because I believe now it may have run amok, it may have run beyond, you know, farther than they intended, but I absolutely believe, having reviewed a lot of the documentation that's out there now, all the stuff that's been released, I absolutely believe that the reason for a lot of the draconian stuff that we did at the beginning was to make the whole situation so serious that people wouldn't be asking questions about how it happened. They would be more worried about what to do about it. I think it was totally an op.
I don't...
With gullible... With
I have no reason... No reason to argue with you on that. I mean, I have no... Other than the fact that If it would have been us, and this was coming down, like how many people were allegedly dying in Milan and all the other stuff, I'm not sure that you and I wouldn't have done the same thing for a couple of weeks, and we would have spent a couple of weeks talking to people that actually knew something and not just people were, you know, covering stuff up. I think the inability to tell people this is what we're up against, this is what we're going to do, and start opening things back up and things like that, and all the crazy stuff that happened afterward, where the restaurant had to be closed, but Sam's Club is selling hot dogs. I mean, all that stuff just sucks so bad.
Better, the restaurant could be open as long as you only sat people at half of your tables, and then you had to wear a mask in and a mask on the way out, but you could take it off to eat, of course.
Yeah, you had to put a mask on to go to the can. Okay, but I'm saying some of the stuff got to be so stupid, and I hearken back to a press conference, because Pritzker, for whatever reason, was having, you know, press conferences every day, and I don't know why you would put yourself through that, but he did. And they had
Governor Cuomo won an Emmy for his press conferences, and everybody else had to try and match him with the same front and center exposure. I'm a leader, check me out.
Well, whatever the... I mean, the stuff wasn't even. I mean, you had, you know, the blue jean stores had to close, and whoever was the governor of Michigan, at least when you went into the Sam's Club, they put a rope around, like, the blue jean section because they didn't want to give them that much of an advantage over other people.
And besides, everybody knows COVID doesn't travel in the grocery store, of the building the same way it does.
I understand all that. But my point is, Pritzker, he's up there this one Sunday. I'm driving back from Audrey's, and it's a Sunday, and he's on there, right? So whatever the governor, I think it was Michigan or Ohio or somebody just did, they just closed something down. And Pritzker had reopened it a week or two before, so he actually was showing some progressive thought. It was the second time they shut the restaurants down. So the governor of Michigan or somebody had just shut the restaurants down again. And they had a couple of these strident, they were all female. Boy, they had the highest pitched voices. I'm like, God bless, what if they were your girlfriend? And they're on this guy like white on rice. And what do you mean you're not going to show? He goes, I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think it didn't work the first time. And by the way, we opened them and it hasn't really, there's this other way. You don't care about people dying? The governor in Michigan cares about people dying and you don't care? They were on it. I'm sitting there going, there's no way this guy's not closing the restaurants tomorrow. If there was one of those markets, I could have made a bet. Sure enough, next morning, it had to be... The abuse people got by not being on the extreme end of this was scary. And if you couldn't withstand it, you made bad decisions, I think, Kevin.
I think so, and I'll go back to what I said about how people don't understand that relationship of data and information and so on. That, you know, clearly if you had a really good understanding and you had the patience to do it, you could sit there and walk people through the decision-making process, what they need to know, and so on. You could, you know, that was doable. And there were people doing it. There were some doing it, not very many, but, you know, there were people out there who were doing a real nice job with it, and Pritzker just didn't have either... He didn't know what to ask, or he didn't know how to explain it, or, you know, whatever it was. He wasn't able to withstand the pressure. And you're right. It was predictable that he wouldn't withstand it. But by the same token, we really needed leaders who would do that, and we didn't have
them. I think it was they weren't getting a whole lot of help from the CDC, obviously. So I don't know if I'd want him in a governor in that situation, would you? I think you were, every time you read something one way, you're reading it the other. And I said at the time, and I don't know, I know a lot of people like to beat up on the press and so forth, whatever is left of the press, when some of them are all owned by some of the plutocracy. But we have some people that listen in Europe, and we have some people in Australia, believe it or not. And, they were helping me out big time. The studies that I was getting that made sense, it looked like somebody actually, you know, did a study not knowing the answer they wanted. The intelligent, I'll say the intelligent shit I said about it, me being no doctor, came from these studies people were sending me from the UK, from South Korea, and from UK, or from Australia. I never read any of that stuff here. I mean, maybe it was around. I don't dig as much as you guys do, but I didn't read any of that stuff here. It was all from these other places where it looks like somebody actually wrote something. The most amazing story was the one from South Korea. I don't know if we had a listener there or somebody saw the thing. Somehow or another, they found some kid. When I say kid, he was like 18-ish, who was just exposed. I don't know how they did it, Kevin, but they corralled this kid and basically put him in, I don't know if they incarcerated him, but he was in, basically put him in a spot in a hospital for the next 10 or 12 days. And they charted the entire, how they got him, like the second he was exposed, but they did. And it was scary. It was so counter whatever people thought. He gets the COVID, so they're testing him. They must be plunking him with, drawn blood every hour, it seemed. The kid exploded in the COVID, and he ended up, he before they even knew what the term was, he would have been considered one of those super spreaders. Said his germ particulate, every time he opened his mouth and breathed, was like incredible. The amount for like a day or two that he was, when he first got it, and as soon as he got even the first small symptom, that as soon as you got it, his blasting air to other people dropped precipitously, and it took like 7 or 8 days to leave him, and they said at no point would he have not gone out and played basketball. He was slightly under the weather, but not enough to. He liked to play ball. He said he would have gone out every day. Then all of a sudden his the antibodies kicked up and they were right in his system, and then he was no danger to anybody after he had it. Now they said for about a 24 or 48 hour period, he was danger. He was almost to the point of being measles. It was that contagious. Then as soon as he felt he had it. And afterward, he was no danger to anybody. None of our plans, none of the stuff we did, seemingly was anything like that, was it? I mean, after I had it?
There wasn't. I personally was tracking numbers because I was paying attention to Michigan because I live here, and I was looking at Michigan policy. And, in my case, Michigan was publishing the number of cases and the number of deaths and the number of hospitalizations. They had all of that by county. So that was real easy. That was easy to download and then to start doing it. And the first thing that you notice right away is that Western Michigan versus the eastern part of the state, Upper Peninsula versus the rest of the state, Southeast Michigan in particular, not just Detroit, but, all of Wayne County and all, that was where the concentration was. Whatever you were doing didn't make sense to be doing it in Southwest Michigan compared to Southeast Michigan, and yet we were going to do one policy for all. That was it. That's the way it was going to be. It made, that kind of stuff makes no sense. It shows that people are just looking at the data. And this is, it's a pet peeve of mine because as an operations guy, this is critical to improving your operations. You have to understand what the data is telling you. You have to understand how you turn data into information, whether you're looking at, the number of items that you get returned to you off of your production process, and then you better understand where, is it by customer? Is it by product? Is it by the date made? What are the reasons for it? What are, if you're going to apply 80-20 to it, what are your top two reasons? Because I probably should work on solving, the biggest cause of them first, because that's where I get the most impact for my efforts. And then after I solve that and I get that down to trivial, then I'm going to have a new biggest one and I can attack that. This is how people in my world are supposed to operate. But people in the political world and in the media world don't have a clue about it.
Or they do, which is worse.
Well, I think I go back and say, to what I said before, the people at National Institute of Health, CDC, et cetera, they know. They know, but I think they were counting on a lot of other people not knowing.
Well, the question that's been once every couple of months I bring up, that we've been doing that for however long we've been doing the show, Who's more dangerous, a stupid politician or a crooked one?
Oh, stupid.
Well,
I'll go with stupid.
Well, I know from my own, and we'll get off this COVID topic, but I know from my own personal experience how, what a pain in the ass it was for me, because I had some small procedure we needed to do right. So I had to go to the hospital for a test, and I'm wearing a mask. And, of course, I go to the hospital, and even with the mask, I get it. So the day before I had to go for this procedure, I had to go in one of those lines. We had to wait in a line, you know, your car. You couldn't even go inside, where they stick the thing down your throat.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a doctor calls me, and he goes, hey, you can't come in tomorrow. You got COVID. I go, where the hell did I get that? I've been home except for the hospital. He goes, yeah, probably got it at the hospital. Okay, fine. So I wait the 5, 6 days, 10 days, and I go to my doctor. I said, I wasn't even sick. Well, I had other problems, but I didn't. That was not one of them. He goes, well, let's give you the antibody test. Well, you know, he goes, yeah, you had it. Look, it's beeping away. You got great antibodies. This is before they even had the shots, right? Well, now,
Yeah. There's
no reason for me to not have been able to have to wear a mask. There was no, and also, there were all kinds of people that were like me. You would think somebody would have said, hey, look, we got this problem. If you're somebody that already had it, over it, and you've got the antibodies, you're in no danger for anybody else, we need volunteers for X and X and X. I would have gone and served dinner at a nursing home if I had to help somebody out. And plus they wanted me to start taking the shots when I already had the antibodies. That's insanity. I mean, and I had to wear, I had to take my card with that I got the shots, and by the way, I had to wear a mask. What for?
Well, remember, in some places you had to have your pass.
Yeah, yeah.
I already had it.
I
find very humorous is that, you know, places like New York City, you know, where you had to have your COVID pass, and you had to be able to show that ID. But damn. You know, they're appalled by the idea that you'd have to show an ID to vote, but that's another issue.
Well, I mean, if not showing our age, Kevin, but if I walked in someplace and they go, well, what, you know, is measles coming back? When'd you get your measles vaccine? I go, I don't need a vaccine. I already had them. They go, okay. Why was COVID different?
There was a lot of stuff to sell.
Yeah, a lot of stuff to sell. Hey, so we've got wars going on. We got oil prices going back up. We've got... How do you get, in terms of an investor, yesterday we were going to the moon all day, and now we've given up half of it, almost exactly half. It's not a Fibonacci. Fibonacci would be two-thirds, so we're not doing the Fibonacci thing. Nobody liked gold and silver, and all of a sudden, 3 days in a row, it's rallying. This is like chaos, Kevin. It's absolute, you know, and I don't know where, when stuff is so expensive, on top of it, and they're pointing, can't wait for the money supply numbers that's coming out on the 28th. If it's a month like that month, last month, they could take this new Fed guy, and I don't know where to put him, if you're trying to jawbone stuff down, but if they don't start corralling some of this stuff, or else figure out, God knows, I don't want to pay it. Well, actually, in some ways, the administration is trying to raise taxes. They found yet another bill to put tariffs on every country in the world, and tax American people. And for some reason, American people are collectively too stupid to realize that they're the ones being taxed. And I don't get that, but they are. Why do we continually want to put a regressive tax on the lower level? And I'm watching these checks that they're sending out to Nike and Walmart and stuff. Kevin, aren't you appalled by this? I mean, I don't know if it's not the party. We're going to tariff everybody. And all of a sudden, oops, we shouldn't have done that. We're going to give it back to those people, and they're not going to... I don't know how much, you know, my stuff at Walmart, if I bought anything there, was up because of tariffs, but it had to be up a little. I don't think they ate the whole thing. Now they're getting the whole check? That's unreal. How could anybody... If somebody's listening from, you know, outer space, they got to be going, what's with these people? Nobody could be that stupid. I mean, I don't know. Every day it just seems to happen.
It's certainly a weird way to rebate it. You know, wouldn't the nicer thing be we managed to send out you know, COVID relief checks to everybody. Why couldn't we just send out tariff relief checks to everybody?
Well, Kevin, you know, in this particular one, I don't think you guys really disagreed. You probably just wondered why I was saying it. Okay, They shouldn't have put the tariffs on stuff, but they did. You know what?
Supreme Court told them was they didn't say you can't do tariffs. They said you use the wrong law to do it. So.
Well, what the Supreme Court said is
it sounds like a distinction without a difference.
No, that was Trump's interpretation. The Supreme Court said tariffs are a tax.
Yeah, they said you read the decision, right?
I read it. You always accuse me of not reading. And it was Bozo that said you could go to another law. What's his name? Trump's flunky. What's his name? The guy who wrote the dissent saying, go use this other law. The majority decision was tariffs are a tax, and taxes are supposed to come from Congress. And that's the spirit of the thing, which, of course, nobody's paying attention to. But the point being is, I really said, don't give the money back. Just let bygones be bygones. Just stop doing it. I don't agree with sending these guys this check, do you? Walmart and Nike?
It seems unnecessary to me. Yeah, Walmart didn't need it.
Well, it's not a question. It's just...
Especially to the extent, and I know they didn't entirely, but pass it on, because you can't entirely pass on the extra cost. But to the extent that Walmart passed on the extra cost, if Walmart wants to come back and say, okay, I got this check back from the government, so now I'm going to cut prices until we, you know, paid off that check, then I would be fine with that, but that's not what they're doing.
Well, even so, you're not giving it to the same people who paid.
No, that's true.
I gotta...
By the way, there are a couple of significant grocery chains that are cutting their prices lately, and that they, you know, at least they've announced it. We'll see what the basket looks like, but you know, that's kind of good to see, actually, that people are saying we understand that it's difficult for families to afford things, so we're going to shave 5% off of our pricing, or you know, or whatever it is.
Well, so, no, those guys are
Midwest yet, but
those guys are in the. I see this only because, you know, I still sort of kind of relax after the show, and well, not only just to relax, we don't know no breakfast places down here anymore since COVID, but I'll rustle up some breakfast for the gang here. Sometimes between the show ending and the market opening. And, but you know, Kevin, the reason why I do it, actually, well, hey, it's kind of relaxing for me. I love to cook, but it keeps me in the food store every Sunday morning. So I'm way more attuned to prices of that stuff than maybe somebody on CNBC might be, because I'm doing it every week. And it's astounding to me when you see... you know, and some of the stuff that is the processed stuff, you see, is going up and it's not coming back down. Like, say, for instance, the fake mashed potatoes that come in a little pouch, they were $1 forever until COVID. And then now they're $1.45 or $1.49. So it's right about the number of the money supply. It's up like 45%. But what you'll see is, $1.49 all of a sudden discounted to, if you buy 5 or something, or buy 7, you get them for $1.20 a piece. Okay, I guess they're down 30% or 25%, but from when? They're really up 20 from 5 years ago. So you could dance around these numbers all you want, right? I mean, you can do this with a pencil or a calculator. You know, it's like... I went to, I used to buy my suits when I had to wear suits to work. This place called Benjamin. My dad went there and everything else. So the guy says to me, we don't want to be in women's clothes. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, you get the dress. You should sell it for $100. You can't do that. You put it out there at 200 and say 50% off, and you sell it for $100. He goes, we don't want to be in that business. You know, but somehow or another, that's kind of where we're at. You really don't know where guys are. Unless you have some kind of a knowledge of what stuff was before, you know, if you're buying pork sausages, okay, they were roughly $3 a pound before COVID, and now if you can get them on sale for $3, you got to grab them, because they're $4.50 or $5 normally now. So unless you have that sort of a history on the stuff you particularly buy, it's kind of hard to keep track, isn't it?
I mean, let's take, you know, one of my favorite things, ribeyes. I love ribeyes. I remember when they were like $9.99 a pound, $8.99 a pound even.
and now they're up like 21, you know, something like that. So, you know, I get excited and have to stock up on them if they get down to, you know, $14 or something like that on sale. And, you know, again, that's compared to what it used to be. It's still a robbery. But on the other hand, if I go out and you want to get a ribeye and you're out, then you're paying $50 for the steak. Oh, yeah. So,
well, I can't believe.
I might as well get my own and grill them.
Well, the price of beef is the Meijers that I go to. It's they must be kind of a I don't know. They get a lot of stuff that if you need to sell it that day, it's cheaper. So my brother cooks every Sunday for the family, and so I called Dan up at 7:30 from the Meijers. I go, you know, you got some pretty good looking ground beef here. It's 25% off because they got to sell it today. It's still $4.85 a pound. He goes, well, I'm not cooking it today, so if we're not cooking it today, you don't want to buy it if they got to sell it by today, so I guess we're out. I go, okay. But, I mean, it was like $7 a pound. Now, I don't know if it really was $7 or they just...
Tom, you can still freeze that. Now, I won't freeze everything, and I really don't like freezing ground beef because there's so much water in the... You know, your pint, when you pay for it by pound, you're paying for a lot of water.
It's hard to freeze the family pack.
You can break it up and rebag it. I mean, if you're really that cross conscious on it, you can do some of that kind of stuff. That's not a problem, and it doesn't take very long or doesn't take a lot of effort to do. So I don't mind that so much, but the idea that when I freeze it and then when I unfreeze it, it's just this, you know, kind of sloppy mess because there's so much water content in there that you don't really realize until you unfreeze it.
Yeah.
That's a whole different issue. So, I hear what you're saying. If I see something on sale, like I said, on ribeyes, I don't mind, you know. Yeah, I would prefer not to freeze a steak and to have it fresh? Yeah, but on the other hand, if I throw a few ribeyes in the freezer and then cook the ones I bought today on the grill today, then that's not such a bad thing.
Well, it's not exactly Stacks and Jacks, but here's a question, because I want to talk a little bit about the FIFA number stuff Mike was talking about. But the why is it when I by the way, I have a pass to the Restaurant Depot, you know, which is a place where restaurants go by. You know, don't ask me where I got it, Kevin, but I got my little card. And so if you want to buy the whole thing, either the strip or the ribeye, when I first started going there, the really good stuff, the choice, well, the prime was a little more, but the choice, which was terrific, you bought the whole thing, and it was $6.99, $7.99 a pound. This is a while ago. Well, now, they were always the same price. But now the strips are maybe $10.99 if you buy the whole thing. But the ribeyes are like 15 or 16. When did the world decide that they like ribeyes that much better than strips? I like the strips better.
I'm the other way. I never buy New York strips, and I love ribeyes. I will buy, you know, a porterhouse or even a T-bone, but porterhouse is basically, it's just T-bone with a little more on the.
It's a combination of the what do you call it, the tenderloin and the strip.
Yeah.
They were the same price, but the rest of the world has decided, like you, that the ribeye is the one everyone wants.
Yeah, it's a little fattier and a little, you know, a little tastier, I think.
But I would get the thing and I'd slice them up. I'm pretty good at that. Instead of $15 a pound, I can slice for $7.80. I can do that.
Yeah, and there you go. You can take New York strip and you can slice it up and make good sandwich meat out of it and all that. And even do things like make yourself some hot sandwiches with some caramelized onion and mushrooms and all that. So yeah, there's ways to go with that. I'm not debating that issue at all. But when it comes to what I just throw on the grill, I very much prefer a ribeye.
Well, there you go. Hey, I ended up talking to a guy last night who's a CPA. Evidently, he's a little bit of a soccer fan, and. After a discussion with Mike on Monday, and of course, you know, Jimmy, who likes to argue, and he's pretty bright about a lot of stuff, we started digging into the taxes. And so the guy next to me says, well, you know, this soccer was a huge success. And I said, okay, by the way, Act like you're on the show. Define success for me. Well, it worked out for everybody. How do you define everybody? What do you mean? I said, okay, pick a city. Did Atlanta, Kansas City, did the regular person end up ahead on this deal? Who ended up ahead of it? Did anybody end up ahead of it? How did FIFA make out? How did the city make out? Did the city, was it a loser or a winner? Oh, yeah, everybody made dough. Okay. You know, explain that to me, Lucy. Did the regular guy who lives in Kansas City, did he make any money? Well, probably not. I said, do you think the city made dough or lost dough? If it, the deal that I saw that Rahm Emanuel said, go pound yourself, they wanted the parking, they wanted the concessions. I said, so how exactly did the city make dough? He goes, well, they had all those people that came there. I said, okay, well, in Chicago, we're full. McCormick Place is full. I mean, I suppose we could squeeze a few more people in here, but we didn't really need to give two of our best hotels to these teams. They're already full because Chicago has a convention business. How can you decide whether it was a net positive or not? And he goes, well, nobody looks at it that way. I go, yeah, I know. That's my issue. But at the end of the day, they had deals, you know, the states that they... I'm sitting there, why Atlanta and Kansas City? Well, evidently, Missouri and Georgia passed a waiver for state income taxes for these guys. And somebody else, there's like five states where they played. I think New England was one, Massachusetts was one of them as well. I don't know about New Jersey. But the FIFA guys are considered a not-profit. So the FIFA money went right to Switzerland without anybody getting a dime. Now, the players allegedly got $51 million. I don't know if that was the winning team or together or somebody. Now, the question was, what if Messi has that deposit in his, you know, Argentinian bank from Switzerland? I mean, the IRS here is pretty good at getting something, but those guys are supposed to pay because they earn the money here. Are they even paying, Kevin? I don't know. Evidently, they're not paying state taxes in those places because they got the waiver, but how come we never get a waiver? I mean, I just wonder, at the end of the day, did you and I take it where the sun don't shine yet again? I mean, I'm not in Kansas City, so it's not, and you're not in, but I just wonder, who makes these deals? I mean, do the mayors just like sitting in the skyboxes for four nights and eating shrimp and drinking booze on somebody else? I mean, what is the motivation for this, and where does it all go, and who ends up getting paid? Why am I always curious about stuff like this when I should just probably shut up and watch the game?
Well, that's probably the psychically is probably the best thing to do, is just shut up and watch the game.
Yeah.
And not be concerned about it. It may have been a good deal. It may have been a bad deal. Don't know. Like you said, Chicago's got a thriving convention business. Does Kansas City? Certainly not to the same extent. So maybe for Kansas City, maybe it was a very good deal because they got all kinds of tourism. You know, I mean, how many do you ever hear people saying, "Hey, I'm going to Kansas City for vacation."
Although
a lot of people swear by their barbecue, so maybe it would be a good trip to do sometime, just to go take, you know, sample all the best barbecue places in Kansas City. But I digress. For them it might have been a good deal. For other cities it might not. You know, does Atlanta really need it? Does New York need it? Well, New York was North Jersey. Maybe yes. I think you have to dig into it a little bit more than, you know, and you may have, but I would say for most people you have to dig into it a little bit more and answer the question locale by locale. Did it make sense? And I don't know the answer to that.
Well, it's the general view that nobody paid income tax here, FIFA or anybody. I don't think they didn't pay the tax on the amusement tax on the stadium tickets that everybody else pays.
Yeah. So what's your next question? Your next question is, okay, how much incremental business did they get out of that, and how much tax money did that generate? It's okay, who's paying the tax money? And that falls back to all the local businesses rather carrying the burden instead of the people who. Instead of any of the FIFA-related stuff, but nevertheless, I think it's a legit question.
Well, it also is the, I don't think people want, you know, my training and yours, obviously, because you're teaching the damn stuff. you got to be rigorous if you look at stuff. And this is what, you know, I remember from the guys like Milton Friedman, because everything had to be extend out your answer for 5 years or something, which is really hard to do. You can say, okay, the bars were packed in Chicago on Sunday, which they probably were. A lot of people, you know, they had all these soccer bars and so forth. Now, the question is, did the average person there, is his bar budget $150 a week? He blew it on Sunday, and he stayed home the next 5 nights. Okay, you're net even, right? You're not net positive. You're net even. That bar did well, but somebody else, maybe he normally goes on a Tuesday night, had an empty bar stool.
Or conversely, you could create a scenario that said, we got a lot of people from out of town that came into the bar,
yeah,
and spent a lot of money, but did that mean the bars were crowded? And we go with the Yogi Berra quote where we say nobody goes there anymore, it's too crowded. You get the you get the situation where the local people who normally would go are going to say, yeah, it's just so crowded, I'm not going to go, I'll stay home today.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you get your offsets, and I think that all has to go in there and be analyzed. And it should be. I mean, that's something that, you know, in the aftermath of this really should be analyzed, because if you don't, then, and if it was a mistake to do it, then you're going to repeat the mistake. And if it wasn't a mistake to do it, then you say, fantastic, let's do it, let's do more of it. I think it just, you just get some variance in there. And, you know, do you think people are going to rigorously analyze it in the aftermath? I tend to be doubtful about that.
Well, if you analyzed every stadium that was built with partial public money, do you think you'd ever find one where the public made out in it?
Yeah, don't know. I'd have to think of a scenario where maybe it could have happened, but I don't know.
But I'm getting
again. It's what and what does public money even mean? Is public money about infrastructure, public money, or is public money about money directly into the stadium? Because there are stadiums built where they say just, you know, do the infrastructure improvements and we'll foot the bill for the stadium. And that's fine. That works for me.
If you and I want to build a stadium at a spot and I think the infrastructure is, God, they're going to have 40,000 people there, I better put an L-stop there. That's the job of government. The soccer stadium down here, we're spending $450 million is the estimate, which is going to be more. It totally essentially doing all the work for a farm field. Yet, if you, what, we just had a place out by her. It was a big, it was kind of a small cornfield, basically. These guys bought it, and they put up all the condos and townhomes and a couple of standalone homes. Kevin, they did all of that, all the sewer. They might have got some help from Orland, and maybe the sewer, you'd probably get a little bit, and probably the gas company maybe had to put their lines in and so forth. The city appears to be doing everything for the soccer field down there. $450 million is a lot of dough to help somebody out with. But you know, even the simple stuff, Kevin, you say, the Bears, look how many people come here for Bear games from the opposing team. And now you and I are going to say, well, yeah, that's money for the city of Chicago. Have you ever heard anybody say, well, wait a minute, every time I watch the Bears on the road, it looks to me that there's 15,000 or 10,000 Bear fans here? Okay, if we get 15,000 from Green Bay, I happen to think Chicago is probably a net positive on this, but every time they play in Green Bay, 15,000 people go and spend money in Green Bay, doesn't that mean you're even? But I've never heard of once somebody say, well, the Bear fans travel well. You hear about St. Louis coming to Wrigley.
I think they're independent events.
Why?
When Bears fans go to Green Bay, and no self-respecting Bears fans should, but that's another issue.
Actually, I'd love to see a game in Green Bay once.
I've seen a couple of them up there. It is a good place to see a game.
By the way, the Irish are playing there this year, aren't they?
In Detroit, that, you know, it's not like the Bears fans are going to go to Soldier Field when the Bears are playing in Detroit. So there's no loss there.
Well, what I'm saying is,
that's incremental for the city of Detroit.
Yeah, well, but the person's coming from here, so the bar bill in Detroit would not be the bar bill here. I'm saying, I think Chicago's a net winner on this, but the fact that nobody even mentions, well, where did the 10,000? I know a group of guys that every year in the game in Detroit they have to train. The train stops, I guess, right near the stadium and right near a hotel by the stadium and by the casino. They have a great weekend. They're real nice time. You know, these are years I'm tempted to go. But that there's money. You can't say that when the Detroit fan comes here, it's all money from Chicago, and forget the part about the Chicago fan going there and spending that weekend's money in Detroit. It doesn't one offset the other?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, the question is, when people make that trip, are they actually losing?
They're just buying a beer in a Detroit bar instead of here.
Well, or would they have, you know, are you talking about people who would have stayed home instead and watched the game at home?
Yeah, the guys I'm talking about would have been somewhere.
When I do, you know, I've done many a Notre Dame road trip, I would have stayed home, you know, I would have stayed home and watched the game at home.
Okay. Would you have invited me over?
You're always invited over. You're welcome to watch the game with me anytime.
Yeah, you just when you see me coming, you like sneak out on the lake, you know, type of thing. Anyway, you guys, it's nice.
Knock on the door and hear me going, Dave. Dave's not here.
By the way, do we have Russell?
Oh, let's see. Let's take a look here.
Yeah, I'm here, but other people are here too that you want to talk to.
Oh, so great, sure.
I probably won't be addressed very much this show.
But you have to say one thing, Russell. I was feeling really bad for you yesterday. Somehow or another, just when you think things weren't bad enough, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm zipping my way through YouTube, which I never should, and I see this thing about the New Madrid fault and how the big one is coming.
I've been in a New Madrid earthquake growing up.
Well, they're talking about...
We had earthquakes in Memphis growing up. But go ahead.
Well, anyway, all they did was talk about this earthquake in 1811, where the hell it was, and what it did, and how many zillion people, and they zeroed in on Memphis.
Yeah.
And now the architecture is mostly regular brick without any side-to-side support, and how the entire downtown would be leveled. I'm sitting there going, hope Russell's not watching this. I mean, it looked pretty bad.
It's not watching it. I'm aware of it. It's just when I was 10, we had a 5-point something that lasted a very short period of time, and you know, because it's the second, it's like the second worst fault in the United States is New Madrid, and that thing that you're talking about there. The one in the 1800s reversed the Mississippi River for a little while, and created a huge lake system in, like, you know, not really northern Tennessee, but north of where Memphis is. It was the one in the 1800s was massive, and the one that I recall as a kid, it felt like a giant truck had gone flying past the house real quick.
Wow.
It was just like a, and that was it. But it was like, what the hell was that?
Well, they were talking about how many aftershocks and everything. It was like a whole year of stuff.
Oh, yeah. That one was the one that you went down the rabbit hole on. That, you know, that's one of those things that they have a whole chapter on when you had to take Tennessee history in junior high.
I said so many people
and
just
were... And because it was such a disaster, I got all fired up and actually learned about it. Can you tell?
Well, I mean, the stuff they were talking about, that because of the soil composition in the water that's in the soil, you had all these geysers that look like Yellowstone piling out of it.
Memphis is on a gigantic... I mean, you're hitting... This is like if we start talking about, you know, Chicago and trains with you.
Yep.
you're hitting... Memphis is on a gigantic aquifer. So, like, all the water that we would drink and everything was supposed to be better than average, and you know, had been filtered down to the aquifer over a few centuries, but because of that, like, you know, nobody had basements in Memphis when I grew up because the water table's so hot.
Really?
You know, the Chicago Bay, yeah, we would hang out in the garage or in the carport. What like you guys do in the basements growing up. That's the basements were just absolutely, you know, foreign to me until I moved up here and made friends with people, etc.
Well, it's like Florida, everybody's on a slab.
Wait. Yeah. You have friends?
Yeah.
No, not anymore, but you know, when I first moved up here I did.
Okay. What do we have? What do we have with
I managed to alienate just about every single one of them, except for, you know, two or three people like Larissa.
Yeah, is she with us?
Larissa, do you consider him a friend?
I do consider him a friend. In fact, I consider him a good friend and a kind friend.
Well, there you go.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I can still fool some people.
And my kids really like him.
Oh, there you go.
Well, that's...
You know, yeah, my thing is I don't care about friends. If children and dogs like me, you know, they're the ones that have the best, you know, the best judgment.
You know, and children and dogs.
I want to jump in. And my turtles like him.
Oh yeah, that's right. I babysat the turtles recently.
How big are the turtles?
They thrived, which means they didn't die.
How big are the turtles?
I have one turtle that's maybe 4 inches in diameter, and then 3 hatchlings.
I'll say the Daffy lady downstairs. She's Irish, so I guess she's Daffy like me. Has a 70-pound tortoise and another guy who's like 40.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, my gosh.
So the weird part is her husband, got to talk about a guy who's going through life. In the wintertime, the tortoise, he's got to carry him in the basement. So he lugs the thing downstairs, and he does not like being in the basement. He bangs with the plasterboard and everything else. But in the summertime, those guys move pretty quick. I mean, it's not like he's a sprinter, but you think they can't move. He can move. She got pictures of him walking around the yard. Just feed him spinach and kale, and he's happy out there. and then the smaller one is, how do those things grow? I mean, but they do, evidently. I go, what are you going to do with this thing? Plus, they live to be, what, like 80 or something?
Oh, yes.
But she's got this, I mean, she's a vet tech. So she's got, you know, like 6-7 dogs and a bunch of cats, and When the husband married her, she had a big snake in the bedroom, and he made her get rid of the snake. He did put his foot down on that, thank God. She made him take the snake to the zoo or something. But I'm good for a dog or two, but maybe a cat. But I'm not so sure. What do you do with this tortoise? Well, what do you guys do? Do you got a big aquarium kind of for him? Are they the wet guys or the dry guys?
Yeah, they're the wet guys.
Yeah, this guy's a dry guy. He's a tortoise, so I don't know what the hell the difference is. But, Larissa, you are, without a doubt, even though we haven't heard you in a couple of weeks and I've missed you, you are probably the most quoted person on the show. Because nobody has opened my eyes up more to the numbers as they affect the people using the gross numbers and how they transport their way down to an individual person. And how, I don't know if you knew you were saying it or not, but you basically said that in times of inflation being higher than people will admit to, the numbers will always look good. It looks like the consumer's healthy because they're spending more, but in fact they might be getting less. And nobody actually made the connection quite as succinct as you did. I don't know if you know that or not, but... You did. So there, congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. That was very kind of you.
Well, I mean, it's...
Is there an award for this achievement? Because Larissa is always looking for awards.
It's Joanne.
I'm sure jewelry would work. You know, jewelry's always good. Especially if it's not fake, you know. If it's something you could resell. But the numbers... The people run the numbers out and... And they come at you so fast that unless that's your livelihood, like it sort of is your guys and mine, it's hard to keep track. I mean, it's you know, as they used to say in the trading floor, you can't take a drink out of a fire hydrant. It's kind of like that. But you always bring these numbers down to, it's like really explaining, you know, what does it mean to be an unemployment number? What is it? How do you define who's looking for work and who isn't? If you actually dig into them, they're almost like useless. But I must have said 10 times in the last 3 weeks, your explanation that of course I'm spending more than last year. Everything's higher. But so you can't get on TV and go, man, the consumer's spending, they must be healthy. It's not a follow-up, is it?
No, it's not.
So what do you... we haven't talked to you in a couple of weeks. What's new? What's new on the agenda? What pearls can you tell me that I can quote you for the next 2 weeks?
That's funny. Well, what's really new is I have adopted 3 new baby turtles. And we're starting to get ready for back-to-school spending. So this is the season for when a lot of customers or consumers, pardon me, are looking to get back into the swing of things. And we're starting to think about what's required for the fall. So we're going to start to see a lot more spending in clothing and school supplies and technology. And I'm excited to see what those numbers look like. I think that these numbers are usually good numbers or indicators of how the spending is going to be through the Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas seasons.
What
it seems to me, though, it's that the volume, the number of things purchased more so than the dollars. And I know what we're going to get reports of on national media. We're going to get the dollars.
Right.
And really, so if you're looking at computers, for example, or you're looking at laptops, it's how many units sold is much more important gauge of the economic activity than the dollars involved in it. And with the price of memory being where it is, the dollars are going to be higher even if the units sold is lower.
I think that's a good point. I also think that the basket of things that we're buying for our students is changing. So it's interesting that you brought up the laptop or the computer. My children now need these things, and they're in grammar school, elementary school, right? And so it's interesting for the, just again, the change in the basket, but I'm also going to be very curious about the replacement. So I think that's also an indication of health. We've spoken many times on this show about how you get a car and now you're hoping that it just doesn't die on you. I'd be curious what that looks like for laptops, how long people are holding on to some of their technology, if they are replacing it, and the frequency of the replacement.
Listen, for a total Luddite,
like a laptop... you can't afford to replace it. You know, can you afford to upgrade the disk in it so that you have solid state instead of normal high density disk? Can you buy some additional memory for it? You can drag out the life of those quite a bit if you can't afford the replacement units. But we'll see, because not a lot of people have the skill set to do it, so they wind up getting, almost forced into buying a replacement.
Could the two of you who know a lot about this give somebody like me and maybe some of the listeners, what grade, pick two or three grades and let us know what the requirements are for the grades, because I have no idea. I mean, in other words, does a second grader need a tablet? Does he need a laptop? Or what about an eighth grader? Where along the chain here do you need all this stuff?
My kindergartner needs a tablet.
Really? So like a the tablet, not necessarily a laptop.
Correct.
It's tablets all the way through school.
Okay.
And it's in luckily we have got three people that can speak to this. I know from meetings that we've had at Kelly, we've got issues with people who don't know how to use laptops when they're freshmen in high school or college when they're freshmen in college, because they've never actually really used one.
I've never used one.
And the part of the issue with that, and I'm going to have to sign off in a minute here, but part of the issue with that is that we all use these learning management systems.
Yep.
I don't know what you guys use. We use Canvas.
I use Canvas.
Yeah. And I have used others in the past, and some of those don't work very well with tablets.
They're not designed for them.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right. I hadn't even thought about that aspect.
We even run into things like people using using Safari on their MacBooks, only to find out
that you can't even use. A lot of the stuff doesn't work with Safari, and so I get students who are calling me up and going, "I can't get to the material." And I say, "What are you using?" "I'm using my Mac." "Or what's your browser?" "Safari." So go download Chrome. Call me back in 10 minutes.
Or actually, once they do that, they don't have to call you back. We'll see you. Download Chrome and I'll see you in class.
I want to close the loop. I want to know it worked. I want to hear that the assignment's not done in a week because we didn't close the loop on this one. So
I understand what you're saying, Kev.
What's a, right,
very so much so. I'm going to ditch you guys, and so I will see you all on the air next week. And Tom, I'll talk to you on Friday.
Yep.
Have a great day, Kevin.
When you guys talk about the tablets, I hearken back to I was in Columbus. My cousin's down, my mother's cousin, and he was an aerospace guy. And somehow or another, he knows as much math as when he graduated college. How he does that, I have no idea. But his granddaughters, they were given the specs for laptop, and I think they were going to Ohio State or someplace. And this is a while ago. He said they got this Microsoft tablet. He goes, it does everything that these laptops do. I mean, there are some tablets that are really good, right?
Yeah, there's the Microsoft Surface, that you can get one that's got like a removable screen that acts like a tablet. I used to have one when I was working at SIBO as an instructor.
Okay,
I know what you're talking about. Those, I don't know. I've continuously gotten the same brand of laptop over and over and over again because I like it and I'm used to it and I know that it works. And I could get the removable screen, but I never used it.
Okay,
it's like I had it, but I never detached the screen and used it like that.
Well,
I thought I would, but I didn't once I had it.
Well, Carl's been ranting and raving about the Micron and those people. The price of like the regular memory, whatever that means, is going way up, and now it's starting to come down a little bit. So I guess the answer to what Larissa was talking about, how much more does that mean? I guess the standard laptop cost for an eighth grader than it did 2 years ago. Is it a lot?
No, but that would be, that I would need to see what memory prices have done and what, and a lot of the memory prices went from maybe like $5 to $30 for some of the lower end. So, for some of the lower end chips.
What's the stuff
that laptops,
when you say RAM and so forth, the things you plug in there, Carl said they went from like 100 to 500 or something. Now they're coming back down somehow a little bit.
That's almost like the commoditized type of I would almost equate that. I was sitting here coming up with a price of steel car analogy.
Okay.
You know what I mean? That's it's kind of like the backbone of the laptop.
Okay. And Larissa, you haven't been on for a little bit, but I wanted to update you a little bit. Hal's digging more into this and you have alluded to this as well in terms of, who can access the capital. And he's going full speed ahead on his study where he's trying to combine the Fed's antics, when you say antics, the increase in the money supply over the last 5 years, with changes in the banking system and how it really has caused, I don't know if you know it, but I remember you said the last time that the K shape that you've talked about, you said the people in the bottom part of the top K were starting to drop into the bottom, into the lower part of the K, and he was trying to make a many, many year correlation between not only is it the money pouring in the system, but the Fed's paying interest overnight, and somehow with the banking regulations that regular people can't access this capital. I mean, regular small businesses cannot at the same extent as somebody else. You've got a big chunk of the population paying 20%, and other people paying 4 and 5% when the inflation rate's really probably 5 to 6. And he thinks that a lot of what you're saying in the K is because of differences in access to capital. And just wonder if you have thought about that at all, or am I just springing it on you?
I haven't really thought about it. But I also think that our I hate to say this, our social economic structure has completely changed. So, and we've talked about this a couple of times on this program, but when you were growing up, people were invested in saving. And if you couldn't afford something, you just simply didn't get it. And the mindset has changed substantially. Now we're in a society where we don't delay a lot of those purchases. You could make the argument that, and I can imagine a lot of people would argue that these are all purchases that we need. These aren't purchases that we have to have. And again, I would push back and say, sure. But again, if we go back 40 years, people simply didn't buy if they couldn't afford it. So at the grocery store, people would be much more conscientious of what they're purchasing. They would maybe get a chicken and utilize that chicken over multiple meals, as opposed to this is chicken and we're going to have a lot of chicken tonight. It'd be a very small portion of chicken served with maybe rice or pasta or some kind of carbohydrate to fill in the gap. And that was one way that people would make meals last longer. And there would be, I remember growing up with school supplies that a lot of my colleagues, this was back in elementary school, they simply just wouldn't get things. And even if you think back to the 1990s, when computers were becoming much more prevalent in the home, not everybody got one right away. In fact, I remember we didn't get one, I think, until 98, 99, perhaps. And in my argument for all of this, no, I think we got a back one in 1996. But my argument for all of this is that those, even though those things might make your life better, you didn't necessarily go out and get a new one. We've spoken many times, my dad's a fairly decent auto mechanic now, because he had to. He didn't have the money to go and have somebody fix a car. Now, granted, cars were structured differently so that he could actually go in and do things. We've made jokes about getting our headlights changed. But again, our society is different. There wasn't as much pressure to buy things or to feel like this is now something that I absolutely have to have, as opposed to previously, we just simply went without.
Well, how much of it, I mean, God, you said a lot of things there. I mean, some of it has to do with, is your attitude that the next year is going to be better and then it isn't, or some shock comes up where somebody extends themselves on credit a little bit, but all of a sudden now, oops, I need a new roof, I forgot about that, now where am I going to, is it bad planning? Is it being shocked at the price of stuff? I buy an older car. Well, it seems fine. Wait a minute, a transmission's $4,000. It used to be $1,500. Where did the $4,000 come from? Type of thing. Is it? I think, but you're closer to this. That a lot of it is you'll hear people talking, about the inflation. And Kevin has mentioned this a couple times, and actually, I was dying to ask you that. The regular stuff, the fact that gasoline might be up a little bit, well, more than a little bit, and some of the stuff in the store, people have somehow learned how to deal with that one way or the other. But they still either aren't aware, why would you be aware, of something that, if you ask them, what do you think a new furnace costs, they might say, $2,000, well, maybe it's $5,000. That nobody is really priced kind of the emergency stuff. What happens if you go to the emergency room and, by the way, you didn't realize that now your deductible on your insurance is $8,000, and they charge you $8,000 for an x-ray on your kid's foot from soccer and it's not even broken. Nobody goes out and prices these kinds of things and said, well, there's a 10% chance of that happened, a 10% chance of this. I really need $15,000 in a bank just in case any of this crap happens. I mean, that would almost be a class in itself, wouldn't it? I mean, but nobody thinks like that. But should they? I mean,
I remember a finance professor saying just that when I was in college. talking about how you needed to be, you know, when you get out there, the first thing you need to do is get 6 months of a backup in case something happens, as far as savings go. And then you and you know, that was the mentality back there. And what I'm doing is I'm actually kind of reaffirming what Larissa just said. So, you know, that was kind of the mentality that you had. And I don't think that that's really taught, and it's definitely not practiced, because I think I recently heard a stat that over half of Americans, if you said, I need $400 cash right now, they wouldn't be able to come up with it.
I've read those statistics too. It's like, it's just
sad, you know. I mean, and I, yeah, it's tough out there, man. I was at my house in Indianapolis, and this sounds so snotty, and I decided I wanted to get out of the house, so I ordered a pizza to go pick it up, and the four DoorDash people that were hanging out waiting to take stuff, they were like my age.
That doesn't surprise me.
They looked like me. I was really, although I still, and Larissa knows this, I still have in the back of my mind, at some point my career is going to go blow up, and I'm going to go back to delivering pizza.
I don't think your career is going to blow up.
I don't either, but there's this weird mental thing that I still think that.
Well, if you're part of any of the layoffs in the financial community here, which the SIBO is a bunch, and Mesro, and one of my good buddies, finally got a job after 9 months of looking, and he actually got a job in the industry with people that had known him before, almost totally by accident, that the guy just bumped into him and said, hey, we're looking for a guy. Because one of these days, I don't know if you guys have done any research on it, even trying to get a job now in the world of AI, nobody will ever talk to you. I mean, your resumes are scanned by something. You don't even get to talk to a person before you're tossed out. Anyway, He was probably 3 weeks away from driving a school bus.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're to where the place there goes, yeah, we love people in their 60s. They always show up. okay then. I mean, it's a job, and I'm sure, it has its rewards too. I remember, I was a janitor and a cab driver for a while, so it's not like I'm going to take a shot at anybody, but... It's not really in your industry. It's not really your skill set. But then again, it's a job.
So I want to jump in here. And what's interesting is we're talking about kind of this Gen X demographic at this moment, right? And so we're talking about, what is Gen X, from like 1980 to 1960. It's like this 20-year period, and we haven't approached how millennials look at saving or spending. And I think millennials have an even different viewpoint on that type of thing. And this is very different than the generation of students that are being taught in undergrads. My current undergrads almost have a sense of hopelessness to them, that they have no interest in saving because what's the point, which is different than millennials who now are raising children and doing things along those lines. I think as you go from the generation of Gen X to millennials to the current generation, you can see the demand or the interest in savings dwindling. And this idea that somehow things will always work out versus Gen X, as you pointed out, we've lived through several major layoffs. We've lived through recessions. We know that sometimes things don't work out and we need to be financially prepared for them.
What, I'm going to jump on you here because I shouldn't do this, because you're female. I'm sensing a real weirdness going on in kind of male-female relationships. When I say that, I talk to a lot of the guys that it's a bad sample, Russell, because a lot of these guys are in Market Reg and stuff. The only real jobs now are from Finner or Market Reg down here, right? I mean, some people are still working for trading companies. These guys have they're good guys. They're smart guys. They all got degrees, for God's sake. Some of them are lawyers. They're making, I don't know what the hell they're making, but they're they don't see themselves ever getting a job they like, right? Like the attorney guys are like, I'm never going to be sent by SIBO to court. I'm never actually going to work on a case. I just have this law degree that maybe gets me a few more bucks, but I never actually get to do anything that I feel like doing. And they are, I'm going to say they're 30-ish. No thought of ever getting a new car. No thought of ever getting a house. But it's getting even worse than that, Larissa. Girlfriend, I can't afford a girlfriend. Family, what are you talking about? And then in the morning, I pick up Andrew, and I see 15 or 20 attractive young ladies piling into the yoga place in the morning, trying to look good to attract the male. And I'm going, and the male has like no interest. I mean, this is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. It's odd. It's almost.
I have to jump in. I don't know that they're going to the yoga place to look good.
I know that was kind of a shot, but the fact is,
I'm saying they seem to be somebody who does yoga. It's about the relaxation, the stretch, and the strength.
It's six in the morning. Well, anyway, but the point being is the ladies are acting more like the world is normal, and the guys are they're not on the same page at all. At least what I see. I mean, the ladies are still, okay, at some point I'm going to get a job, I'm going to get my education, I'm going to find somebody, and by the way, the right guy, and I'm going to have a family. The guys are like, that's never happening, I'm never going to have a dime for that. And to me, there's like almost like a disconnect. I don't know if you're seeing
I also think that women are now much, especially younger women, are much more empowered, that they don't necessarily look to men as a financial stability or somebody that they need in their lives. And I think men are responding to that of saying, well, if I, one, can't afford it, but two, these women aren't putting me and saying that they need them, it's a compelling of a story for marriage and things like that anymore.
Well, if you can have a bunch of kids, it's kind of nice, but anyway, but I'm saying the whole thing seems different. I'm not blaming one side or the other. I'm just saying when you have somebody who's 30 years old thinking they have no future, it affects a lot of things. It affects dating. It affects families. It affects babies. It affects car. The other day, you see this, you read this stuff and you can't even, General Motors comes out with these earnings and they say the earnings are great because they've been able to keep their pricing up. In other words, they raise the prices. Well, duh. Same day, President whatever comes out and says he's going to increase tariffs on cars from Canada for 50%. Well, we have an auto company, you tell me they're doing great because they're raising the prices and the people can afford it. And you have a president that says, well, I'm going 50% higher. It won't be 50%. Tomorrow I'm going to tax you even more. And what are we doing here? Is this some kind of a nightmare I'm going to wake up from or what?
Yeah, and again, I think these are societal pressures, right? We have so many different viewpoints being pushed out to particularly younger generations. And I think critical thinking has also changed as with newer generations. And when you have so many different bombarding messages, it's hard to make sense of what's really happening. And as a result, I think a lot of people are simply not thinking about it. They're putting their head in the sand, so to speak.
I'll say some of the misinformation that's flying around the press, is that affecting, you're teaching people a little younger than Russell, at least the group that I saw from Russell. If you walked into your first class and said, by the way, and just write the word tariff on the board, would the whole class be able to tell you who's actually being taxed on tariffs and work its way through from something coming from another country to here or whatever? Do they know any of that, or are they just... I mean, they probably do after you're done teaching them, but just as general knowledge, what is the general knowledge of people on this stuff when it's so back and forth in the press? And these are economic principles, and it seems like people don't seem to have a clue. Define unemployment, define this. Can anybody even do that?
No, I found that most of my students are incredibly reactionary. So if I were to write the word tariff on the board, I would get lots of opinions, none necessarily based on economic principle, but more as a reaction, whether or not they support the president or don't support the president, and would make arguments about the president's behavior as opposed to the actual impact on the economy. They couldn't do the latter, but they definitely have opinions on politics and they don't understand how those politics impact them, but they have a knee-jerk reaction to the idea of a tariff.
Really? I mean, boy. You let them get away with that?
Oh, no. Oh, no. But you asked what would happen if I put the word tariff on the board, and because we talked about the war in Venezuela, and I said one thing, and the amount of reaction I got, and I thought, okay. And so then I stopped the conversation and said, we're going to talk about the actual impact of oil prices and how oil prices impact almost everything you do and everything you touch because of the production of different products and because of the cost of carry of products and things like that and transportation of products. So my point is they didn't understand that part of it at all, but they were so, had such reactions to the war itself. And I finally had to, again, stop it and say, this is a finance class, not political. It's not a political class. And we have to understand, we don't have to agree with what the president's doing, but we still need to understand the impact of what is happening now.
Yeah, I mean, the lack of curiosity in some of this stuff is sort of beyond me. I mean, we used to have to do, okay, we're going to put a tariff on, Mercedes Benzes. What happens? And you had to work that all the way through. It was not political at all. It had to do with, okay, these guys pay this, these guys pay that, these guys might absorb some here, they might absorb some there. By the way, the competitor now gets to raise their prices because their competition is up if it's not perfect competition, which it never is. I mean, we're going to put a tariff on dairy products. And the first thing I did was look up how much do we import from Canada versus export. Turns out we import $340 million worth of dairy products, and we export $1 billion. I'm sitting there going, okay, politics aside, how exactly are we getting screwed? it's some of the stuff is almost laughable. And I think that's part of the plan politically, that to blow so much by people, you can't ever chew on one before the next one hits you. It almost seems like that's a strategy. I don't know, am I going goofy here on you or no?
No, that's a strategy beyond. The whole distraction thing is exactly what they're doing to us constantly.
But somewhere
it's constant. There's all kinds of constant misdirect. They're always trying to misdirect us. Look at that. I want to pass a law that says that the names that they have for laws have to actually match up with what the law is going to do.
So you're saying
that's interesting. I like that.
Do you know what I mean?
Can't have
everything's going to be cheap act. But in reality, because of the way they're doing things, everything's going to go up by 50%.
Yeah.
I've gotten so sick of, the what they call different laws versus what they're actually doing. But that's a base, example of just the misdirection you're talking about.
I guess why are we? I think to be honest with you, people like you can't keep up. Every time you teach one principle, you're on to another one the next week.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the fun part of being a business professor.
Well, but I think that
especially a finance professor, because things are changing. There's always something going on in the world to talk about. I can never be a history professor, except we continuously revise history, so I guess I could. It would keep changing.
You know what you'd love to teach, though? Because Hal actually taught a semester. I think you'd love to teach, and I bet Larissa would love being in there with you, because that was one of the fascinating classes I ever sat. It was a two-quarter class in Chicago. By the way, we sat around like a big boardroom table. It wasn't even in a class. And guess who was in the class? We talk about a name. Steve Schwartz.
Oh, wow, really?
From the Schwartzatran era.
Yeah.
They were the first, Larissa's kind of history in. When I first started the business, if you wanted to model your options, right, to use something called a Moncheck-Weber. The problem is there'd be 15 machines. You know, I used to get in there at 6 in the morning so I could go look for neutral spreads and stuff. Well, the minute somebody else got on a machine, they all slowed down. They all pulled from the same mainframe. Well, Steve Schwartz was the guy who invented a machine where all they got was the feed, and the machine did the work. So it didn't matter how many people sat there with Schwartzatrons. They all could calculate themselves. So he essentially invented, what would you even call that, Russell? The independent computer where you come into the office, the next guy comes in, yours doesn't drop by half, and the next guy by half, till finally none of them are moving. I don't know what that even means. Carl would know that.
Is it distributed computing?
It must be distributed, yeah. It must have been distributed.
I don't know.
I don't know what to think. Anyway, but...
if I were taking a test right now and I had to fill in the blank, that's the word I would use.
But this class probably affected me more in terms of economic knowledge than anything else, because it was called the History of Economic Thought. And they took every society from, like, day one, agrarian, you know, any kind of industrial revolution, whatever it was, and they went through all the different numbers that we talk about. Okay, how does this number go? How does China have a 6% growth rate and we have 2? Stuff like, well, okay, if Russell and Larissa are next to each other at a farm, and Russell's better at growing stuff and Larissa's better with the animals, well, then Russell's going to probably, he's going to sell her the corn and she's going to sell him the milk. But if it's barter, none of it's counted. But the minute Larissa and Russell don't like each other, and Russell takes his corn to town, and Larissa takes her milk to town, and they each have to buy it there, where it now gets counted. In fact, you didn't get anywhere. You still got the same amount of corn and milk, but now it's being counted because it's being run through. So when the Chinese people go from the farm into the city, everything you do, childcare, whatever it is, now is counted when it didn't before, but you actually still did it. And they go through unemployment rates and how people are actually... It has to do with... You learned about every single, essentially, economic statistic and where it came from through agrarian reform and industrial revolution, how it was all counted. And you get a sense for the numbers that are blown at you every day. And I think it was a real good education. So you kind of remember the basic definitions of this stuff. And you don't get blown away as much. Not that you don't. You do. But anyway, I think you guys would love that, because I bet you'd be really good at it, teaching a class like that.
Oh, I completely agree. I don't think there's any room in the business education curriculum for it, but I completely agree that this would be one of fabulous class to teach. But it really expands students' minds for understanding how our economy came to be, how different societies look at their economies, and so that they are better informed to become better critical thinkers and understand this at a deeper level.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the first one, this guy, not too long, he just croaked. He was like 99. You ever hear of a guy named Coase? I forget what his first name was. But he ended up at the University of Chicago, and I think he taught till he was like 89 or something. But he wrote the signature piece on essentially economic externalities and pollution, and you know, and you can easily be deflected by, you know, the global warming, this, that, and the other thing, but it basically came down to, you took a town in Scotland or someplace, got a factory, and people started working in the factory and so forth, and the factory's belching smoke, and he didn't go into lung cancer or anything like that. He took a very simple thing. Before the factory got there, people used to whitewash, before they had paint, their house and their fence once every 5 years. And now they pretty much had to do it every 3 years because this crap got on your house and your fence. And that the factory didn't pay for that. That other people had to pay for that. So the term he used was an economic externality, where you're able to put costs that you essentially should be paying for onto other people. So whenever you hear anything about pollution now, I immediately think back to the article, okay, these guys are forcing these guys to pay for stuff that they should be cleaning. Once you get the principle down, it's kind of easy to follow. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think once a class knows exactly how tariffs work, I think whenever they hear something from somebody, pro or con, they get to drop back and say, okay, what's really happening here? Right? And I think you guys are in the forefront of this fight, but I can't imagine how you can keep up.
Well, again, part of the problem is just making sure that there's space in the curriculum to cover these types of topics because they're so important. When I brought up the oil prices, this was actually in my risk management class, and it wasn't something that was on the schedule to cover, which meant that I had to shift some things in the class to make sure that we could have enough time to talk about it. That's one of the reasons why Russell and I started making these videos specifically so that we could be able to talk about things that are currently happening and give some perspective of how they actually work, because a lot of times we don't have space in the curriculum.
Well, do you find yourself getting knocked off topic?
Well, or the students, yeah, knocked off topic. But it also gives us more room to really explain what's truly happening behind the scenes. So, for example, there's a video we put together on what it means to be a market maker.
Really?
And,
wow.
You know, we take some of that institutional knowledge for granted, but a lot of these students have no idea. And so it's an interesting thing that we're doing. And again, it's to address some of the things that you're discussing right now.
Do you leave yourself time to be knocked off on some of the stuff that's current?
Some, but there's a lot of demands for how much we need to cover within the class.
Okay.
Russell, would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I do that. I think I've mentioned it on here before. I do that Saturday office hour thing where any of my students, current and former, can show up between 8 and 10 central on my Zoom, and I'll answer anything. And those conversations are, some of those could be an episode of this program.
Really good.
People will show up and, you know, they'll want to talk about refinancing their mortgage. And because I mostly have graduate students, and that is kind of the conversation. It's pretty unfortunate. I rarely have undergrads that show up on Saturdays. It's almost always just the graduate students.
Has Larissa met the gang that I met that one night?
I don't think I met those specific students.
No, I don't think there's any. You know, maybe one or two of them.
Okay.
Larissa. From the CFA competition stuff or whatever, because there are a couple that are still around. But
I thought that was fabulous group.
As an aggregate, the answer would be yes.
Okay.
Because she taught in that program, but not those specific people.
Because I thought they were fascinating.
Yeah. No, they're great. I was made fun of for not having friends at the beginning of the program here, but that's probably the most social thing that I do every week.
Well, if you're ever around here, invite me back, because I only made it through about a third of them, and I was dying to talk to the other, but we were too long.
Yeah. No, that class, the Chicago-style finance, it's on the schedule for next year.
I really thought the young lady that was a nurse and it was the insurance business was pretty damn fascinating.
She got cold feet about coming on the radio with us.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, we...
She got cold feet. I thought I was going to have her last week when Larissa wasn't going to be here, and she just at the last second she said she just wasn't comfortable doing it.
Really? You say knocked off topic. That was the beauty of the class I took from Milton Friedman, because he hated teaching it and everybody hated learning it. It was a theory of price. God, it was awful.
So he just talked about what he wanted to talk about.
Yeah, but he had the manuscript there. He goes, because the reason why this is still in manuscript form is I got tired of writing it, so I figured out how would I'll just put the manuscript out there. Like, okay, nothing but graphs with a zillion lines on them. I'm going, I have no idea what he's talking about, all this calculus. And more graphs than you ever saw in your life. And like I say, he didn't want to talk about it, and neither did we. So the first guy who knocked him off topic, that was the topic. I don't think
Hey, how about them Cubs?
Yeah, how about them Cubs? What do you guys think? I've challenged Larissa with this a couple times, and you. What if you just walked in on the blackboard showing my age and said, put the word profit up there? How would your students today, in this crazy world we live in, how would they define profit? And the wrinkle I want to add to that is, what do you think of this FIFA stuff? No taxes, no nothing. They're a non-profit, and all the money went right to Switzerland, and good Lord. I mean, if you add that on top of the discussion Can anybody even define profit today?
Yeah, it's cash flow.
Well, and it's funny you should say that, Russell, because as an economist, they define profit very differently. Mm-hmm. So you've got accounting profit and you've got economic profit. And they're very distinct things because in economic profit, you need to consider opportunity cost, which is an interesting aspect or dynamic to it.
Well, it also comes down to control. Do the owners really control the place? If they don't, everybody gives himself a bonus. There's never any profit. But is there really?
Oh, I love talking about agency theory.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's I'll pull up. Have you here's something for you to look on the YouTube for. Have you ever seen the Tyco chairman's wife's 40th or 50th birthday party that he used company puns to pay for?
Oh, this isn't the one in France where they had the ice thing.
No. This is the guy from Tyco in the U.S.
Okay.
Yeah, he held a Roman orgy themed $2 million birthday party on company funds for his wife. And there are videos from the party, like on YouTube. And when I say Roman orgy themed, you know, I get everybody snickers in the classroom. It looks like they're at Caesar's Palace. You know what I mean? It's like everybody's just kind of, all the people waiting on everybody are dressed like that. But it wasn't all gross, but that's what the people on CNBC like to refer to it as.
Who was the guy that had the one in France with the ice statue where the thing was essentially peeing vodka or something? Who was that guy? He went to jail somewhere.
I don't know, but I want to hang out with that guy.
Yeah.
Somehow. That's the party. I don't want to go to the Roman orgy themed one. It was kind of sad looking. In reality, but these are the people, man. The French are the best at derivatives, and the French, they know how to party.
Well, Larissa, where exactly, if that's what you wanted, well, show my nature, how do you open up the yellow pages and find somebody that can make you an ice statue that can pee? where does that skill set come from? How do you even, anyway, I think of the stupidest.
Well, it's funny, there is on Purdue's campus a Purdue Pier. So this kid apparently will thwart authority and pee in different, fountains and stuff.
Oh, God.
I think one of my kids would aspire to be the next Purdue peer.
They've had a few people here that can't wait to go pee on the third rail, and every one of them is, like, dead. Can you imagine somebody dumb enough to do something like that? I don't. You wonder what? Well, what? Because I mean, even the stuff about profit, this FIFA, I don't think they're paying any taxes anywhere. Is with what I was.
You know, you got to have Rahm Emanuel on.
Yeah.
Because he specifically looked at what FIFA wanted, and he said, "We're not bidding."
Well, they wanted the parking, they wanted the concessions, they wanted all the rooms paid for. I have a listener and client who said he's from California. He said, Santa Barbara, they basically took over the 2 5-star hotels, and all was on California. I think I want to come back as a FIFA.
Oh God, yeah, you want to be a FIFA official? There are, I mean, the amount of bribery to win the World Cup back in the day. When did the U.S. host the World Cup before?
It was in Chicago. Was it 94?
Is it 2000? The 90s or whatever? Well, apparently, when there was a lot of bribery involved in that, and one of the things that a lot of the FIFA officials that got to make the decisions got was their kids got full rides to top schools in the United States.
Really?
Yeah. That was part of the bribery was there was almost one upsmanship on the bribery to see that you could win it. And, you know, part of the United States delegation, well, you got a kid that's going to, you know, be college age. He can go to Stanford for 4 years. They would work with us on this. Ooh. I mean, the amount of underhandedness for, you know, awarding the World Cup back in the day was ridiculous. It probably is still the same.
Well, excuse me for being me. How the hell does the comptroller of the city of Chicago write an $80,000 check for your kid at Stanford? Who the hell's the auditor?
Well, no, that's not. I mean, it would be, you know, somebody that's on the host committee for you know, FIFA that has an in with somebody at the university. It, you know, it's the whole who you know type thing.
So it's somebody who got the contract for the beer at Soldier Field would write that check.
No, it's not like that.
Okay.
It's not. They don't even have an economic interest in it. They're just,
okay. All right, I get it.
You know, they're just, we want this for our city. Yeah, I could pull a few strings for that. But it was a ridiculous amount of string pulling. And the bribery was, it wasn't money. It was more of unique experiences that we can make sure can happen for you. You know, like your kids are going to get into a top U.S. school or, you know, other things like that.
Larissa, I think you and I do not have the imagination it needs to be a really good crook.
I do.
What does that tell you, Larissa? I don't have the imagination for this. I just don't.
I would be an excellent criminal.
So you think Russell could turn into Nucky in Boardwalk Empire real quickly?
If he wanted to.
If I had the desire to, yeah.
I still like the line where the guy says, you can't be half a gangster, Nucky. Either in or you're out, you know, type of thing. Larissa, when does school start for you? Are you guys both at the same time, or are you on different one quarter, one semester?
Russell, do you know when Purdue starts?
I do know when. We were having this discussion at the, because I have a Purdue student in the household. You guys start the week of the 24th.
Okay, that sounds
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I just heard it from somebody just yelled it at me from another room.
Excellent.
Yes. So, but my quarterly graduate stuff starts the week of the 17th. So, Chief, I teach on three different calendars because I teach in three different schools, and like I'll have it. So for me, it's really confusing. But undergrad Purdue starts the week of the 24th.
Why does a quarter need to start before Labor Day? And semesters didn't use system.
Because we do four quarters a year.
And oh, okay.
That's,
right.
That's just how they kind of work out. But the quarterly schedule for the Indianapolis campus and the quarterly schedule for the Bloomington campus disconnect sometimes.
Really?
And I teach them both. So I'll be like in week three in one class and week four in another class, which sounds kind of minor, but it doesn't make things easier, that's for sure.
Well, Larissa, are you doing freshman, sophomore, or what are you? What grade, what level are you in this year? I know you've done a bunch of them.
I'll be working with juniors and freshmen this year.
Really? Which class for each?
I'll be teaching finance with Excel, investments, and retirement planning.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do with a guy like me who uses Excel to put numbers there but still adds them up on a calculator?
Well, as we've discussed earlier, my students don't know how to use a laptop. So the beginning of the semester is always a little rough.
I've never used one. What's the difference between a laptop and a regular computer?
Mm-hmm. Nothing.
Okay, well, now people that travel around.
I mean, you can carry one around, and you can't carry the other one around.
Because I know Audrey does all her business on her laptop, obviously, because she's always going from place to place. But for me, I sit in front of this thing for 12 hours. I really don't need a laptop, I don't think. I have another one at home. But they're the same thing, right?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I don't think I might ask. I'm really curious now, and I might, Larissa, you should do this because it would work better for you. Ask your students how many of them actually have a desktop at home.
Okay.
Yeah, just because you're only teaching undergrad for the fall, and I'm only teaching graduate for the fall. Maybe we'll do a survey, and we'll see if there's an actual generational difference there.
Hey, we're way over, guys. Which I always
are we way over?
Well, but it's okay. I always want to go over when you guys are here. But Russell, you got to ask. I'm going to ask one more question. What's the story with Japan? I'm doing the. There's a couple of people on YouTube talking about, I mean, they can't get this yen back under 160. It's 162 and a half. Are they still fighting it? Are they cashing in bonds to do it? And I don't know. Last week I also didn't tell you the 2 month increase in margin loans is the highest on record. It's like $200 billion. I mean, what's going on here?
They've had an artificial situation that's catching up with them. Well, unfortunately, I don't think it's natural within an economy to not have a general increase in prices over time. And when you don't have a natural increase in prices over time, you're willing to finance things over a long period of time because you're not going to end up in the hole. And now they're having to adjust to, a world where they are going to have to start spending more for the raw materials that they use to make things, et cetera. And as that starts to work its way through their economy, people are going to have to get raises. They're going to have to let some people go just to maintain profitability. And unfortunately, there's a lot of cross ownership. Like, the central bank owns a bunch of the equity ETFs, et cetera.
They own like 9% of them or 20% of them, don't they?
I know, which is, not really what I think the function of a central bank is supposed to be.
When you pull up the page that says Japan is invested, they own $1.1 trillion, down from $1.2 trillion, by the way, in the last few months of U.S. treasuries. Is that Japan government, Japan central bank, Japan banks, Japan people, all the above? What is that?
All the above.
It's all the above. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Larissa, incredible to hear your voice.
Thank you so much. It's so good to be back.
Whenever you can pile on, because I mean, I'm going to say you give a perspective that nobody else gives, and then we talk about it with all the other guys. So you don't even know you're doing it, but you are.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it was so great to hear you and to be on. And Russell, I always enjoy our conversations.
Plus today, it looks like we can breathe. The air looks like it's cleaner. You guys, were you beat up with that down in Indiana as much, Russell, or was that just here?
I've been here the whole time.
Okay, so you were beat up with it.
Yeah, right. I don't think it was as bad down there as it was here. There was that one day you really, really shouldn't just go outside, and I don't think it was that bad. I think there was a Thursday, maybe last Thursday.
Last Thursday.
You didn't even want to go outside.
It was three times worse than the old record.
Yeah, so I didn't go outside that day, which is pretty easy for me as an academic.
Do you guys remember the only time I ever saw when I was young, people, especially over in Beverly, they used to have all these trees. People would burn all their leaves. It was just like that. when every homeowner on a Saturday had a fire in front of their house burning leaves, that's what the air was like. But then, of course, you can't do that anymore. But anyway, guys, you take care of yourself. SP Futures down 27. NASDAQ Futures down 270. Again, not quite half of what we were up yesterday. Yesterday we were a big update. Today we're kind of going the other way. Andrew, nice job. Back tomorrow. Stacks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.